Off the Ball, GAA.
But with the new rules, you feel like you don't understand the game anymore to an extent, in that, you know, these 8, 10, 12 point leads do not mean anything like what they used to before.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Hey there, it's Owen here, and you're welcome back to Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball. In every episode of this series, we go to a different country in Latin America, and this week we're heading to Peru in the aftermath of some political turmoil in their country, and also in the aftermath of my cycling accident across the border in Bolivia. As always though, we're going to be starting this episode with the latest installment of the hitchhiking journey in Patagonia. Now this is going to be the longest installment of hitchhiking yet, so if you're here for Peruvian content, it is coming right after a particularly dramatic hitchhiking slot. And a reminder that the previous installments of the Patagonian fiasco are at the beginning of all the previous episodes. A heads up as well that there's going to be some bad language in this episode, and a 5-star rating for the podcast would be fantastic if you enjoyed it. Cheers.
Okay, it is Monday morning. I am in a little village called Tilly on the Atlantic coast of Argentina.
I've been hitchhiking the length of Patagonia for the last week or so, and I've now covered around 1,200 kilometres. I still have over 2,000 kilometres to go before I get to Ushuaia, which is right at the southern tip of South America. It's where I need to get a flight from in the middle of next week. Now, I want to get myself to the town of El Chalten en route, which is over in the Andes.
Didn't take many videos yesterday because yesterday was a fucking successful day.
I'm still on the other side of the country, along the Atlantic coast. El Chalten is a little under 1,000 kilometres away, and the plan today is basically to eat into that distance as much as I possibly can. Now, I was told at the reception of my hostel that going south first and then travelling west would be the way to go about this. I want to travel west first though. That way, I won't be going over the same road on my way down to Tierra del Fuego in a few days' time. I presume my logic is innocent and relatively inconsequential, but even then, my expectations for an easy day are pretty low.
Today, I expect to be a bit of a shit one.
My expectations, I'm afraid to say, would turn out to be very well placed.
There's not many cars around. It's a bit of a walk to get out to this road, unfortunately, so it could be the guts of an hour before I actually get the thumb out.
An instant win. I'm not even sticking my thumb out when a car pulls in. The driver is a man named Gerardo, who sees me in my backpack and knows exactly where I want to go. He drives me towards Route 26. He's en route to his job in a school where he's going to teach kids to use audio and video editing software.
Soy profesor de audiovisuales, de cine, TV. They learn how graphic designs, record music, making videos.
Genuinely sounds like the greatest subject in any school in the world.
And so this is the... Acá está la ruta 3.
Okay, and then Route 26.
Gerardo explains to me that I'm soon going to have to leave Route 3 to get onto Route 26. And Route 26 will go on for about 200 kilometres. That'll take me across the country, where I link up once again with Route 40, at which point I can start moving south.
Gracias. Thank you so much for stopping for me. I really appreciate it. It's a big help for today.
I was... In Argentina, I was making this
years
ago, so I know what it is.
Yeah, you helped me out big time. This is a long walk.
Yeah. Be careful because it's cold.
Yes, I have lots of clothes. Take care, bye-bye.
It is bloody cold. But the wait isn't long. I'm standing on the side of Route 26 for about 10 minutes when Martin pulls in.
Owen, es mi nombre, mucho gusto.
Owen,
sí.
Veo raro el nombre.
Martin is telling me that he's making a 12-hour journey up to Neuquén as part of his work as a welder. He lives in Comodoro Rivadavia, which is where he's driving from this morning.
¿Te gusta?
No.
Mucho viento.
Mucho, sí.
He doesn't like it because it's too windy. He's originally from Misiones, way, way, way up in the north of the country, and his parents are from Paraguay. Martin is a good man. If this wasn't abundantly clear when he picked me up, it is when he offers me some of his mate.
¿Conoce el mate?
Sí, conozco. Es muy bien.
¿Conoce el mate?
Yeah, conozco. Tomas todos los días, ¿sí?
Sí.
He gets a great kick out of my failure to understand some of the questions he asks me.
No me entiendes.
And I've stopped doing the polite thing of refusing to say, what? More than twice when I don't understand what is being said.
Deja vu, conoce.
De ya, ¿qué? Disculpe, amigo, me has tenido.
But he gets an even greater laugh when I tell him the story of me having to drive the car of the man who picked me up yesterday. And I show him the picture of me driving someone else's car down Route 3. We drive past a protest and past the lakes at Sarmiento. We're making good progress. And we reach the end of Route 26. Martin must go north from here. I need to go south, so we say our goodbyes. And I say hello, once again, to my nemesis, Route 40. A greyness has set in, and the landscape at this particular junction involves nothing. In Charles Darwin's Beagle Diary, he writes this entry under the 29th of September, 1836. In calling up images of the past, I find the plains of Patagonia most frequently cross before my eyes. Yet these plains are pronounced by all most wretched and useless. They are only characterized by negative possessions. Without habitations, without water, without trees, without mountains. They support merely a few dwarf plants. Why then, and the case is not peculiar to myself, do these arid wastes take so firm possession of the memory? Route 40 and its arid wastes have firm possession of my memory as well. The sort of barren place, you know, you'll never fully forget. Out of the grey comes a car. The car is also grey. It stops 20 metres in front of where I'm hitchhiking. A man gets out and runs off the road towards some of those dwarf plants. He needs to go to the bathroom. I hover by his car and I wait for him to come back.
Hola, amigo. Más sur as possible.
Yo me voy hasta la gira, me voy.
¿De dónde es? ¿This?
The man is going as far as a place called Rio Majo and asks if that'll do me. I say,
yeah, sí, por qué no?
Why not? And I get out of the wind and the rain and into his car, which is barely shielded from the wind and the rain. This is another man called Gerardo, and unsurprisingly, he's looking to sell this car. The asking price is 700 pesos, so you could buy two of these cars for the same price as one pint in Dublin. The only living things we pass down Route 40 are guanaco and a full unit of police. In fact, we need to stop for these police. Gerardo tells me to prepare my documents.
Buen día, ¿cómo le va?
I'm asked to produce my passport. And they can't find my stamp I should have got when I entered Argentina. Which is precisely the moment I remember that when I arrived in the country a couple of weeks ago, as in when I stepped off the ferry from Uruguay, I did find it strange that I walked straight out into Buenos Aires without a passport check.
¿Papel para entrada?
¿Argentina?
No creo.
¿No?
Entrada con la lancha de Uruguay, sí. Buenos Aires.
Sí.
Y no tengo nada.
The police go away to their van to closer inspect my passport. Gerardo tells me I may need to leave the country to get a stamp and come back in.
So necesito salir y...
Exacto, vos tenés que salir y volver a entrar.
Oh, como para no, hacer. No.
Pero no creo, porque eso capaz que te van a hacer el papel.
Oh no, that would be fucking shit, man.
We are a 2.5 hour drive away from the Chilean border, so it's not like they'd have to send me far.
Mucho tiempo.
Sí, perdemos mucho tiempo en esto.
It is taking a while. The police return to the car with my passport in hand and they tell us to carry on and have a nice day.
Porte. Nada.
Nada. Al pedo.
Sí.
So my conclusion is that the police clearly don't see me as potential bribe material. I know I look disheveled and haggard, but this is a new low. I blame the 700 peso car. Not long after, Gerardo needs to peel off left, and so it is back into the cold, soulless embrace of Route 40 once more.
So it turns out the further south you go, the colder and windier it gets. Funny that. I am somewhere close to Perito Moreno, so I'm not going to be able to walk it. It's absolutely freezing, mainly due to the fact that the wind is blowing.
Progress could be a lot worse today. I've travelled 371 kilometres in around 7 hours after 3 different drivers. But this is my longest wait of the day. However, it's very manageable because it's only 40 minutes. It's 10 past 3 in the afternoon and a Chilean truck driver called Victor pulls in.
¿Eres de Argentina?
Chile.
Chile, ah, muy bien. ¿Vas a Punta Arena?
Victor is not a friendly man, or else he's just immediately realised that he despises me. I don't really care. He has enough of a heart to let me sit in his truck, and therefore, I personally think Victor is Jesus Christ reincarnated.
Entiendo.
I immediately realise we have a significant problem. The winds outside are strong, very strong, and they're getting worse. Victor says he's pretty sure he's not going all the way south today, as it's not safe in these conditions, which is obviously totally fine, except he doesn't know when or where he will stop. Which is less than ideal given he could leave me in the middle of nowhere with very few daylight hours remaining. And remember, I don't have a tent with me. I literally cannot afford to get stranded. We approach the town of Perito Moreno, and I have a decision to make. I can get out here, try get a lift with more certainty before the sun goes down, and if I fail, well, at least I'll have plenty of accommodation options here tonight. The next significant urban setting is a town called Gobernador Gregores, but it's going to take us 5 hours to get there. I decide not to blink. I bank on the fact that Victor might be bluffing, or the fact that the wind may die down as we head further south. So we drive on for an hour. And a second hour. Victor starts to slow down at some sort of settlement. I wouldn't go as far as calling it a village. It's merely a collection of small shacks, well in off the road. He pulls in, and he says to me, "No mas. No more." Okay. Right. Shit. One of the shacks is a makeshift cafe / petrol station / hotel. I get a hot cup of coffee and I stand out in the road. It's so windy that the coffee is spilling out over the rim of the cup and burning my hand. We're about 2 hours away from darkness and I need to get one last lift to get to safety for the night. I know deep down that Victor might well get back into his truck at some stage this evening and keep going, so I'm not overly worried. And sure enough, he does eventually come out from the cafe, and he sits into his truck. A short time later, he turns on his engine, presumably just to turn on the heating to warm himself up. And he sits there, with the engine on, for a little period of time, but he's going nowhere. And then, he begins to drive. He drives along in front of the cafe, he drives out a sideways exit to get back on the same road again. And he continues his journey south, along Route 40, without me. This is the most brutal rejection yet. There are clearly multiple exits from this shack, and I wasn't standing at the one furthest south. He didn't even need to drive past me and look into my desperate eyes. I've played the situation terribly. And I'm reminded once more, I truly am terrible at hitchhiking. I wouldn't be starting to worry now, except for the fact that really, I haven't looked like getting another lift whatsoever. It's like the traffic has just finished up for the day. We tick towards 7:30. And there is some good news. I am now looking at a beautiful sunset. And there is some terrible news. I am looking at the sun setting. Shite. Darkness descends. It's time to play the final card and see what the quote-unquote hotel is like in this shack.
Tienes espacio en el hotel tonight?
I go back up to the counter where I got my coffee a few hours ago, and I ask for a bed for the night. And I'm kind of stunned by the response.
No.
The response is, no, there's no room. Completely booked out. I had this picture of some sort of version of The Shining in my head, where I would be in an unusual deserted hotel for the night. But no, this place clearly isn't deserted. This place is full.
Donde?
Aquí en la vueltita.
Just aquí? Gracias.
Mercifully, the woman behind the desk offers me one final opportunity. There's also a hostel here, she says. If I walk behind this building, there's another building, and I can ask for a bed there. Great. I go outside, and sure enough, there's a sign on sticks that reads "Hostel" in red capital letters. I step inside. And honestly, I haven't truly panicked at any point so far. I've always realised there's a plan B, C, D, etc. But this might be the first time I feel a bit of panic. Because the The woman running this hostel tells me...
¿Tienes espacio anoche?
No.
No.
No, no me quedo.
They are also completely booked out. I just can't comprehend how this can be a thing. All these beds being booked out in the middle of nowhere is absolutely not an issue I foresaw. It turns out there's a heap of bikers who are en route to this hostel. The winds are so strong out there that they won't be able to go any further on their journey tonight, so they've booked out the whole place. By way of an olive branch, the owner of the hostel points to a corrugated iron shelter outside. She tells me that I can pitch my tent there.
Disculpe, no entiendo.
No, no, te está diciendo que si querés armar carpa, puedes armar de aquel lado.
Oh, no tengo un carpa.
No. ¿Y en el hotel no fuiste?
No, no tiene espacio.
¿Y
en
el lugar tampoco?
No, yo no tengo lugar, porque las motos vinieron y...
Okay.
Disculpame.
It's a kick in the balls and a massive win for all the haters out there who told me that I wouldn't be able to pull this hitchhiking journey off without a tent. If I was a football manager, I'd be getting rightly slammed for my terrible game management right now. I should have brought a tent. I should have hopped out at Perito Moreno when I had the chance earlier today. I tried to bite off more than I could chew. I learned that this place is called Bajo Caracolas. Good to be able to put a name to a nightmare.
Es posible comprar comida aquí?
The hostel has a food menu, so I order a chicken milanesa. And the final insult is when I'm asked if I'd like to dine in or take my food away. Into the dark, windy night in Patagonia, I'm pretty sure I've got absolutely nowhere to take my food away to. I have no idea what the fuck I am going to do tonight. Three months later, I'm in Peru, and I don't have a lot of time. If you've listened to episode 3 of this series, you'll know that I disrespected an ancient Andean goddess during my time in Bolivia, and as a form of karma, I ended up smashing my face after falling off a bike, ending up in hospital, and losing weeks of my trip due to the recovery from surgery. I'm now on the home stretch, but because of the delay, I now need to fly through Peru as quickly as I can. Another problem is that I need to go even quicker than anticipated, because when I arrive in the city of Cusco, I've gone to stay at a Wild Rover hostel. A proper, authentic Peruvian experience. I've gone from being stuck in a bed for a number of weeks to a hostel basically centred around a massive Irish bar. And as a grown adult, I'd like to distance myself from taking responsibility for the subsequent days of drinking that seem to run into one another. It is the Wild Rover's fault. It is the fault of feeling free once more. It cannot possibly be my fault. And while the Wild Rover Hostel is obviously the main tourist attraction in the Cusco region, there is also a place of interest called Machu Picchu. Needless to say, a broken nose, smashed nasal cavity, and multiple consecutive days of drinking is basically the optimal preparation for a 5-day hike at altitude. But even despite this perfect preparation, the Salkantay trek is still a little bit of a challenge. Take the Salkantay Pass, for example, at 4,600 metres above sea level. This is where I find having a bloodstream entirely comprised of Pisco Sours really stands to you.
Yes.
Here, to do that.
It's breakfast time on the fifth morning of the trek.
I really fucking hate mornings. Yeah. Like, no, I hate mornings more than you. Yeah. Tried once again to fly this morning and couldn't, out of disappointment. Yeah. Day 500 of being a hen, I still can't fly.
And a level of smugness has built up inside of me that's greater than any level of smugness I may ever have experienced in the past. We've hiked roughly 70 or 80 kilometres over a few days, and we've finally come in contact with the people who have taken the train or the bus and skipped all the walking and the climbing. And when I'm walking along the train tracks when the train goes past, or when I'm going up that final climb when a bus speeds past me, it's definitely me who feels smug. It's definitely not the person sitting in comfort looking out the window at the people slogging out their last few kilometres that are smug. We arrive at Machu Picchu at sunrise. And now it's time for the section where I tell you something that hasn't already been said on a podcast about Machu Picchu. And that concludes the section where I tell you something that hasn't already been said on a podcast about Machu Picchu. Thank you for listening. Given it's got one of the highest average elevations in the world, it's no surprise that Peru attracts some hardcore mountain climbers. I've now moved on to the town of Arequipa, where the volcanoes of Coropuna, Ampato, Hualca Hualca and Chichani all tower above 6,000 metres.
And how high is Ampato?
6,280 metres. No, it's very high. A glacier.
And I've got chatting to a mountain guide called Carlos Sarate, who's generous enough to speak to me despite a lack of confidence in his own English. He climbed his first volcano over 6,000 metres in 1973, and he now runs the family mountaineering business that has been going since 1955. He also trains the next generation of mountain guides, and I'm quite interested in what makes a great guide.
One mountain guide, I need many characteristics. The more important is the good condition, physical condition. No? After I work at the personality, one guy, they are the responsibility with the other person. Entonces, this guy, they are one good cabeza, buena cabeza.
Good head.
Criterio. Many, and I don't know the name in English.
He means good judgment.
Tener buen criterio. Many times there are the weather is changing. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, I look the guide. The new guys, no? When the weather is not good, the new boys in mountain, there are many problems. In Spanish, it's nervioso, muy nervioso.
He's talking about seeing nerves in his new guides.
There are many possibilities. The in Spanish is errores,
making mistakes.
Is cometer un error. In yeah. Spanish, cometer un error. When he's nervioso for the weather. Mm-hmm. Or there are the times, there are the tormenta.
Okay. A storm.
There are the electricity.
Yeah, the lightning.
Yeah, entonces with us I look, there are many. Entonces for us it's important the instructor, no? Look the situation.
Be tranquilo.
Tranquilo. Si there are one good guy, it's tranquilo. It's no problem. Tranquilo. Atención. The recommendation for the security, for the other. Entonces, estas es importante. But when it's out the season, there are many problems. The snow, the raining, the electricity. Entonces, that is good for the new guys, no? For me, it's new guys. That is good. It's
yeah.
Right? There are, in Spanish, there are un dicho de marineros.
Dichos de marineros are sailors' proverbs.
Un mal clima forma buenos marineros. No?
Bad weather makes a good sailor.
El mal clima forma buenos marineros. No? The weather is not good is the new person working in the ocean and in the sea.
Carlos's business is still making up for a challenging few months, not long before my visit. The tourism sector in general has taken a bit of a battering. So for some context and a disclaimer as always that this is not a comprehensive breakdown of what was and continues to be a complex situation.
Tonight, Peru's democracy is on the brink after a day of political chaos.
So, December 2022, the left-wing president of Peru, Pedro Castillo, is ousted by Congress and he's arrested. This happens after he announces the illegal dissolution of Congress and the establishment of an emergency government. To many, this is obviously seen as an attempt at a coup. But supporters of Castillo view the right-wing Congress as the ones attempting the coup, and they believe that they're seeking to overthrow the president unfairly. it sparks a wave of protests against the new president, Dina Boluarte.
Across Peru, violent protests are intensifying. Anti-government protesters and police taking aim at one another. The number of injured now in the hundreds, and it continues to climb.
Those protesting are generally of a far left-leaning persuasion, and there's also particular anger within indigenous communities, a group that has felt politically disenfranchised for quite some time in Peru.
The demonstration spread to Lima on Thursday, with injuries on both sides. As thousands poured into the city, many from remote Andean regions, demanding the resignation of President Dina Boluarte.
Demonstrators demand the dissolution of Congress, the resignation of the new president, the release of the old one, and they want fresh elections and a fresh constitution. A national state of emergency is declared in the middle of December 2022. The next day, large-scale protests in the town of Ayacucho are met with a brutal response. The Peruvian army chases protesters into streets and shoots directly at them. 10 civilians are killed. Less than a month later, the city of Juliaca in the department of Puno witnesses a similar massacre. 18 people are killed at the hands of the police force. In May 2023, about a month before I arrive in the country, Peru's Supreme Court rules that protesting in the country is illegal and is not protected by constitution. Now, former President Castillo is still in pre-trial detention, reform has not happened, and any ideas about bringing forward fresh elections appear to have been shelved. The next general election in the country is in 2026. So obviously, when I'm in Peru, things still feel pretty raw, and it's only been possible to travel freely through the country again for a couple of months. There's also a bit of a reluctance to talk to outsiders about what has happened, and there's an even greater reluctance to talk to journalists. Peru's own media largely overlooked what happened in Ayacucho and Juliaca, so there's not exactly a great trust in the press here. One of the main reasons why tensions often exist in a country like this is that much of the natural resources of Peru are in the countryside, but all the benefits are seen to go to those in the capital of Lima. And it's something that Carlos echoes.
Yeah, Lima is big. Many, the industry is in Lima. The second sector is Arequipa.
Yeah.
And many times it speaks del centralismo.
Yes.
Un centralismo, only one big, big tet, the other.
Yeah.
For this country up. Yeah. It's changing this.
They need to change.
It's changed. It's important. It's que, the Peruvian, that is special people. For that is very, very special people, the Peruvian. It's not one cultura cívica.
Sure.
For the elegir for the new president, for election, the new president, the Peruvian many times is not... The Peruvian men is no piensa. No.
He says the Peruvians don't think about the right person.
For the good person. No?
Yeah.
This country, there are many possibilities for the work, the good work in Peru. The only problem that is this person que is no good work. No?
Yeah.
La política is no good.
It's
que this this in Peru no is no study this in Peru. In the school before, there are one course for the political course. Now it's no more.
But Carlos, totally understandably, doesn't feel overly comfortable talking about this subject.
Well, the political is many, many, many possible for speak, but no. Yeah. I don't know more in politics. No? It's more climbing, mountain, tourism. That is
that's
my
your work. Thing.
Yeah.
Fantastic. The journey to Lima is memorable because one very angry passenger throws a massive tantrum when she isn't allowed off at the street she wants to get off on. She tries to grab the steering wheel and then delivers a good kick to the driver's door when she eventually makes her way off the bus. In the meantime, I've got in touch with friend of the pod, Dr. Pete Watson, for a bit of a crash course on where sport sits in this geopolitical minefield in Peru.
There is that kind of limeño superioridad, the Lima superiority, and it's racial and it's economic and it's historical and it's power-based. And that creates resentment. At the same time as they're looking down their noses at, you know, the rest of the country, you know, there is a lot of resentment that is emerging from, you know, the countryside areas towards them. You know, I mean, again, this is why the Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path guerrilla organization in the 70s and 80s were a rural organization that did not emerge from Lima.
The Sendero Luminoso used Ayacucho as its base for its campaign against the Peruvian government, the town that witnessed the massacre of December 2022.
The Peruvian provinces have very rarely featured as a key part of the football imaginary in Peru. It's something like before 2022 World Cup, there had only been 22 players who weren't born in Lima or Callao who came from the provinces in all the World Cups that Peru had ever played in. So that's, you know, just under a fifth of the total amount of players. And Callao is effectively Lima's port city. It's not far from Lima. The kind of footballing centralization was attempted to be solved in 1966 when they create a league called the Liga Descentralizada, the decentralized league. 1966, you know, England are winning the World Cup in that year. You know, you've got teams all the way from Carlisle down to probably Plymouth and Torquay that are part of the country. You know, 1966 is the first time that other teams outside of two cities are allowed into the Peruvian supposedly national league. You see uprisings not only from indigenous groups throughout the colonial period, and again into the independence period, you get uprisings from indigenous groups, but you also get uprisings from local strongmen. In Spanish, the word is caudillos. Often, actually, caudillo becomes the nickname for the great leader of a football team. One of the great disasters of Peruvian history, the loss of the War of the Pacific against Chile, is down to the fact that the country can't unite. You know, Chile invades, the elites in Lima are largely unprepared to fight. The indigenous people are obviously unwilling to fight because they say, oh, why should we? We, you know, you've never done anything for us in Peru. Why should we suddenly fight for our country when we don't see it? And again, you know, the Chilean invaders were told specifically, do not target indigenous people. Keep them on your side. Again, it's the same thing with the Afro-Peruvians. You know, they think, well, why should we fight for a country that hasn't given us anything? But that kind of military disaster, 150 years ago, is kind of very, you know, very symbolic of the fact that the nation had not integrated. And again, a lot of the way that football is used in the first years is trying to say, well, let's modernize. We need to play football to develop stronger, fitter, more able Peruvians who can fight for the nation if we have to make it. So that was kind of, again, a kind of founding principle of why football became important in the 1920s, 1930s. Say, you know, we've lost these wars. How can we try and create a Peruvian youth that will fight for Peru, that will feel more fit, that will feel more strong? And then the next question that a lot of Peruvian intellectuals are wrestling with, you know, Mariátegui, one of Che Guevara's great influences, saying, right, how do we make indigenous people part of this? Because they need to be part of Peru as well. And it's still an ongoing problem in many ways.
I would say more that, like, we're sore losers, but we're sore losers in a different way than the Chileans and Argentinians are. Like, the Argentinians and Chileans, they will get in brawls if they lose and they can't accept it. Whereas we won't get in brawls, but we will more try to justify the loss with silly excuses.
I'm in Kennedy Park, named after JFK. It's in the Miraflores district of Lima. It's a park known for its countless wild cats roaming about the place and also for its outdoor chess tables. I sit at one of these tables to chat to football scout Brian Bertie.
And for many years, the club scene was kind of depressing. Like, stadiums weren't filling up. They're very empty. They were only filling up in important games. Like, people say they're fans, but they didn't go. But that has started to change after the pandemic. After the pandemic, at least the two big teams in Peru, La Universitario and Alianza, they're filling up every game. They're filling up every single game in like it's actually kind of difficult to get tickets now.
Wow.
Because it's filling up every single game. When I was a teenager, the stadiums never filled up. They were pretty much always empty. It was kind of depressing to see.
Tenemos clásico, lo vivimos aquí en CMD. Se para la gente, la tiene Piero. Espera el chino, espera a Ramírez. Va Piero, la buena pelota.
I posted a few months ago on Twitter what my opinions of the best derbies in South America is. I might be a little biased, but I said Universitario vs Alianza is the fourth best because for two reasons. One, the stadiums fill up and they have atmosphere all the time. Even when there's worst moment, they always brought people. They always fill up. And two, there's more of a reason for the clubs to hate each other more than just being the best club in each city. Like, it's kind of a racism thing. Like, La U is supposedly the... There's two ways to look at it. La U are the white people team and Alianza are the black people's team.
Right.
You can also see it, the way I see it personally, is La U is the Andean team and Alianza is the coastal team. Obviously, that's not as true anymore because times have gotten more modern, but that's how we saw it, like, that's how people saw it many years ago, and that's how the tradition says. And the thing is, Andean people are very racist towards black people, and black people don't like Andean people either, so that racism has kind of brought it onto football. Alianza has their firm grasp on the Chincha region, which is where most of the Afro-Peruvians come from. And that's why most black players play for Alianza at some point in their careers, like, or they start there.
Wow.
Because they have a firm grip on that area. And Alianza has also been more of an academy historically than Universitario. Universitario has always been more of a team that looks to win immediately. So.
Okay, that's really interesting. I need to ask you, though. I mean, like, you were saying it's the fourth best derby in South America.
Opinion, yeah.
It's on the Mount Rushmore of football derbies in this continent. Who are the three that join him on that mountain?
Boca River, obviously. My second favorite is Grenal, because there's always a derby field with Gremio Internacional, just to be clear. They always fight each other. There's always plenty of reds, so I love the derby. I think three is Peñarol versus... Nacional, that's the one I had three.
Okay. That's a hell of a list. So that's like a little travel diary for anybody who wants to tick off or potentially create a new bucket list of South American football.
Part of the reason why losing a few weeks in Bolivia was problematic was that I missed the opportunity to visit the Amazon there. Access to the jungle from La Paz is supposed to be pretty straightforward, but I decided to leave it for a couple of weeks until I was at least able to breathe properly through my nose again. And so, I head to the Amazon straight from Lima. The obvious play here would be to hop on a flight up to Iquitos in the very north of the country, but I've recently become a hardcore believer in this thing called travelling on a budget. And so, the cheap option is to travel somewhere else in the Peruvian Amazon and to get there via land. And so, I hop on a Movil bus on a Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And I arrive in a town called Moyobamba on the Friday night at 8 o'clock. I've not just plucked Moyobamba out of thin air, to be fair. The reason I'm here is that there's a big Amazonian John the Baptist-related sesh taking place all weekend. More on that in the morning. In the meantime, Jose, the man who owns the hotel I'm staying in, has come to pick me up from the bus in his tuk-tuk and bring me to his accommodation.
Ah, okay, perfecto.
Alex!
Alexander!
Ah, qué lindo. Sí. Muchas gracias.
quarter to five on a Saturday morning and I'm walking towards the main square of Moyobamba. I've been told that it all kicks off at around five in the morning, but it feels like I'm walking towards some sort of party that's already been happening in the darkness for hours. The whole town is awake. Everyone seems to be in some sort of uniform. Most of the men are wearing crisp white shirts and black trousers, while the women are wearing colourful dresses. They pair up and then they start to dance out of town. The dance is known as the Pandia Moya Bambina, and it dates back to the 16th century. My understanding is that people from all parts of Peru have descended on the town for the celebration, and there's a large swathe of Amazonian-born people who have returned from their new homes in bigger cities around the country. I do get chatting to a woman called Mariam, who is an English teacher at a school in Moyobamba.
Wow. If I want to talk about Moyobamba, we are going to spend all the day talking about that. But the most important is that this is a really beautiful city. Here, the people is really, really friendly. People here love joining together to parties, to dance, and they really enjoy their traditions.
While each couple is dancing and continuing their journey out of town, they're also swirling these white handkerchiefs in the air as they dance. And they dance for a few kilometers without stopping. And they leave the town entirely. And then everyone arrives via dance at these thermal baths. The name of this festival is the Festival of San Juan Bautista, more popularly known to English speakers as John the Baptist. Obviously, it's fair to say that dipping the head was kind of John the Baptist's thing, so I'm sure you understand where we're going here. We've gone to the thermal baths to dip our heads and give ourselves the sort of blessing that JTB himself will be proud of. Then comes the food. A dish which involves rice, olives, meat, egg and spices all mixed together and wrapped up in some leaves, and served with some boiled bananas. It's the sort of food that would keep you full for an entire 28-hour bus journey. And it's called huane. Juan, huane, you get it. There is some suggestion that the dish could be a specific reference to the head of John the Baptist, given that the story of his beheading was popularized amongst the Peruvian Amazon when the Spanish invaders arrived. The only certainty here is that huane is absolutely delicious. And while somewhere like Lima can rightly claim to be a fantastic capital city for food, the country as a whole can also claim to be a powerhouse in the culinary game.
I mean, can you confirm Peruvian food is the best in the world?
Of course.
Number one?
Yes, the number one, because you have many kind of flavors on it. For example, you tasted ceviche?
Yes, of course.
Of course. I just realized yesterday there are more than one type of ceviche, and I really don't imagine how you can put ketchup in a ceviche.
Disgrace.
Like, yes.
I would like to apologize on behalf of Europe for this, for destroying your dish like that.
Oh my gosh, yes. So yeah, it's okay. More. It's amazing because most of the foods here, it has the most traditional things and ingredients here.
The closing stages of the dance involves a group of children bringing a tree into an upright position, almost planting it in the ground. Then another child comes along with an axe and cuts the tree down. And the treasure, in this case sweets, falls to the ground for the kids to collect. It's clear that this party is for everyone. There's no way to really define the demographic here because it seems to be everyone. It seems that the families are sticking together, most of them are multiple generations dancing through the streets.
Well, I think Peruvian people love this one because since we was born, our parents include us in all these festivities.
Okay.
Because if you see some party here from San Juan's parties, you see child, babies, they are in the party. They don't, it's not just like to say, oh no, he's a baby, no, we're going to keep them in home. No, babies, child, young people and all those people, they enjoy together. And I think there is another reason is that we really, I don't know is that the correct term to say it, conserve our old people in homes.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah, because we really love our grandparents or our great grandparents.
Sure.
Because they enjoy that with us still, and this is another reason because children spend most of the time with them in homes.
Yeah.
And we, for example, here we don't have a house for grandparents or parents.
It's
for,
all one.
Yes, for example, we have just one, but people prefer to spend most of the time with old people in homes, with grandparents, great grandparents, and that is a reason why children learn from them, from the past. I think that is why we love this kind of festivities.
Gracias.
Unfortunately, it's time to leave the party behind and go a little bit deeper into the Amazon. I've been given a contact for a man who runs tours through the rainforest along the river, and so I hop on a 5-hour bus to the town of Yurimaguas, where the roads essentially end. Travel to the next towns can only happen via boat, and so I hop on a river boat for a 4 a.m. departure. It takes us northwest along the Huallaga River, and less than 5 hours later we are dropped on the shore of a small town called Lagunas, just short of the Marañón River, which is the principal source to the Amazon River. I walk to the office of my tour guide, and I'm picked up by a woman driving a quad bike which is latched onto a trailer of supplies. Her job is to transfer everyone that has signed up to go on this tour today. I am her only passenger. It's not exactly what I expected, but she drops me off by the banks of the next section of water, and I meet my guide, Aseli. I give Aseli a hand transferring all the supplies from the jeep's trailer to his boat. There are cooking utensils, lots of rice, and there are 8 big bottles of Coca-Cola and 4 big bottles of vodka. Aseli and I sit into our wooden boat, and we paddle away. This is Asele's backyard. He knows this place inside out, and he's full on whistling back and over with the birds. He seems to have this unbelievable sense for when a family of monkeys are about to jump out over our heads. And he's got a serious ability to make the most of the resources available to him. He has his fishing rod, which he's clearly made himself, with a bit of bamboo and some line. This man is a wizard with this rod in his hands. Every few minutes we stop rowing the boat so that Aseli can go fishing, and he's come up with dinner for today, tomorrow, and to be honest with you, the rest of the week. We eat this fish every single meal we have for the 3 days I'm on the river with him. At one stage, his fishing rod snaps because he's caught such a big fish, but he just tapes it back together and continues to pull more fish out of the water. In fact, he gets so confident that he starts using a spear to catch fish. He throws this thing into shallow water to try catch more food. Sadly, I witnessed 0 kills with this spear. There is little to no sign of life being truly disturbed by humankind on our journey down through the river, until we arrive at a wooden structure a few hours in. It's a raised platform under a straw roof, and a long plank of wood connects this to a tiny tower upon which sits a totally unplumbed and exposed toilet. This structure is either unfinished, was once upon a time finished, or maybe this is what finished looks like around here. Asele cuts open the fish he's caught, flings the bones and guts into the river, and then washes the fish out in the brown river water. To start a fire, he needs wood, so he takes out a machete, and he starts hacking at the structure we're currently standing on. A structure that was once upon a time finished, then. He gets a fire going and gets the fish cooked, and Asele serves up a killer meal. Before he puts the frying pan back into the boat, I notice him using the pan to ship water out of the boat. Everything is going to be just fine, I'm sure. We arrive at our accommodation and there are other signs of life. In fact, there's a big group of people in this hut in which we're staying. They're a group of Russians travelling the Amazon, and the Coca-Cola and vodka is for them. Their tour guide managed to get onto a satellite telephone last night to get a message back to the town to send alcohol with the next boat coming down the river. The Russians don't offer any of this alcohol to the rest of us. But after dark, Asele takes me out on the boat again. The red eyes of the crocodiles are visible under the surface of the water, and Asele grabs a baby crocodile to give me a close look. And then releases it back into the water. On day two, we continue down the river. We go traipsing on foot for a bit through the jungle. And Asele seems disappointed that he can't catch any fish because we're on dry land. When we get back to our hut, there's an Englishman named Josh who is finishing up his trip through the rainforest. He tells me that he recently went on an ayahuasca trip, and he repeatedly experienced the same intense vision during his trip. He's lying on his back, and he keeps visualizing a massive tarantula on the ceiling looking down on him. A couple of hours after I first meet Josh, there is a slight bit of commotion in the largest room in the hut, where dinner is being cooked. It turns out a large tarantula has just dropped out of the ceiling. One of the guides uses a brush to brush it off the raised hut and out into the bushes. We are then told to not look too deeply into the roof of the hut. I am back standing at the edge of a river in the Amazon in the pitch dark.
Kerry with four wins and one loss so far this summer. Tyrone, of course, with two defeats.
I've woken up to get the 5:30 a.m. Saturday morning boat from Lagunas to Yurimaguas. There's no reception here, but there will be Wi-Fi in Yurimaguas.
Paulie Clifford, Gainey involved, Shoddy O'Shea, lovely movement, great score.
Is Wi-Fi really that important? Well, Kerry are playing Tyrone in an All-Ireland football quarter-final today. The half-five boat will have me in Yurimaguas just in time for throwing.
Sullivan goes short for Kerry. Takes it back there from David Clifford. And Tom O'Sullivan eases it up into the air and curls it delightfully over the crossbar. And Kerry are leading by 5-2.
The problem now is that it is 5:45 a.m. At 6:55 a.m, the boat finally shows up. It's actually kind of impressive how the boat was delayed by almost exactly how long it takes to play a full game of football. I will be sitting on this boat for the duration of the match.
Jason Foley driving it ahead. Shoddy O'Shea transferred quickly, taken back beautifully by O'Connor with his left. That's a lovely score.
And so I envisage every possible way that Tyrone will win this game. I plan exactly how I am going to deal with my heartbreak when I get back to dry land.
And this is a nice looking move. And here's an opportunity as that ball is lost by Brosnan, but regained once again and put in the back of the net by Dermot O'Connor.
And I stare out the window in a melancholy manner, thinking I should have stayed in the depths of the Amazon with the snakes and the spiders, safe from the wounds that Tyrone GEA can inflict on my soul.
Kerry out of sight.
As we approach Euromaguas, I hear a phone. Someone on this boat has reception. It's actually the English guy, Josh, who's sitting right behind me. But Josh may as well be from an indigenous tribe in the Amazon in this moment, because I have to explain to him that he needs to get onto the Kerry GEA Twitter account immediately. His questions about GEA and Kerry can wait. And the 30 seconds it takes for him to carry this out feels like an eternity.
Eases it down, one against two, and somehow the brother, David, kept it in play, and it's an opportunity for another one, which O'Shea will surely take. Couldn't miss.
None of the information he sees on his screen makes any sense to him, so he just turns his phone to me. At Kerry Official, 37 mins, second half. Kerry 218, Tyrone 12 points. Kerry point from Sean O'Shea. Boom! The boat now full of bemused Peruvians, wondering why this stupid gringo has suddenly started celebrating like a madman.
It's another one for Kerry. They're on their way to the semi-finals, and who's going to stop them?
I never end up seeing Josh again after we say our goodbyes in Euromaguas, but I'm sure he thinks he's tripping on ayahuasca again when the news eventually reaches him that Kerry do not go on to win that year's All-Ireland. This has been episode 7 of Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball, produced by me, Owen Shahan. If you've enjoyed the series so far, your likes and follows and positive ratings are much appreciated. My handle across social media platforms is Owen Shahan, as all one word, and there is video content across those platforms to accompany this podcast, and all of that information is in the show notes. We have now reached the latest point of this series chronologically. But in the next episode of Diverted, we will bring you part one of the stories gathered in Argentina. We're going to be going from their national sport of pato to the hurling club of Buenos Aires, and the story of how my hitchhiking ordeal led me to the family of one of Argentina's 2022 World Cup winners. Chat to you then. Thanks for listening.